neither Alzheimer's nor Parkinson's disease are predominantly heritable conditions. They're diseases of midlife with symptoms that emerge in late life. You throw into the mix metabolic dysfunction and the like, and I think it creates a perfect storm. Making a feature-length documentary is incredibly difficult. She is the inspiration behind everything that I do. This film really has to be a tribute to what it was that my mom went through, you know, so that people will feel less alone in that journey.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Oh my goodness, friends, I am so excited about today's episode. It was such an honor to have Max Lugavere back on the show. He really is a legend with all of the work that he's doing supporting our health and wellness, especially when it comes to brain health. You're probably familiar with his New York Times best-selling books, Genius Foods, Genius Life, Genius Kitchen. And it was such an honor that he reached out to come onto the show for his new documentary, Little Empty Boxes. He actually told me he wasn't going on many podcasts for it. So I am just so grateful for this moment and for all of the work that he's doing and sharing it with you guys. I can't recommend enough checking out Little Empty Boxes. It is haunting. It is eye-opening. You will learn so much about what it's like to live with somebody going through cognitive decline, as well as the science of the process of it and lifestyle choices that can potentially help. We dive deep into it in today's episode. We talk about what that experience was like making that documentary, Max's relationship with his mom, the role of diet when it comes to brain health, the problems and myths of Alzheimer's drugs, the shocking role of amyloid beta in brain health, how it might actually be protective, the role of genetic testing and risk when it comes to Alzheimer's, the role of exercise, what Max would do if he found out that he was diagnosed with cognitive decline, like what he would do right now, and so much more. Definitely check out the documentary. It's at littleemptyboxes.com. It won Best Story at the LA Documentary Film Festival, and it is 100% worth your time. Check it out now. Hey, friends. Did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/melanieavalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com. melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/melanieavalon. And new customers use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hey friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii, not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. There will be a full transcript as well as all of these links in the show notes. Those show notes will be at melanieavalon.com/little empty boxes. There will also be two episode giveaways for this episode. One will be in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post, and again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. All right, I think that's all the things. Without further ado, please enjoy this fabulous conversation with Max Lugavere. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation I am about to have. I am here with a repeat guest. And okay, so the backstory on today's conversation, a long time ago, I should know this date. When did you first write Genius Foods?
2018 it came out.
Okay, so 2018, I read a book called Genius Foods. I think I actually listened to the audiobook, and it was absolutely incredible. That's when I was really getting into more health, wellness, biohacking, all the things. And I really appreciated its approach to diet and lifestyle for addressing health, in particular, preventing cognitive decline and supporting our brains. It was amazing. And what's really surreal, so 2018, I'm trying to think like where I was in my life at that time. All I know is that I was in the beginning more of this show. The show probably wasn't even out yet. And Max Lugavere, the author of that book, I loved it so much. He was on my dream list of when I had this show of somebody to have on the show because it was just so incredible. So when I had him on the show, I think a few years ago now, that was amazing. I really, really loved it. And since then, Max has released other books. So Genius Foods was a New York Times bestseller. He also has Genius Life. I think that's what he came on the show for. And Genius Kitchen as well. He has the Genius Life podcast. And most recently, friends, I am so excited. I got an email from his team because Max had his directorial debut called Little Empty Boxes. And I I didn't know what to expect going in. I was wondering if it was going to be, so it's a documentary. And so I was wondering if it was going to be more about, you know, the science and interviews with different people and things like that. It has that. It definitely has that. But more so than that, it is this beautiful, haunting, tragic, overwhelming story shot over, years and years. So we can talk about that, of Max with his mom as she's beginning to experience and continues to experience cognitive decline. So you get an actual look into his life as he's going through this with his mom. So not only is there this incredible emotional connection, but then you really see what it's like to live with somebody with Alzheimer's or cognitive decline and all the different options that, you know, they and the family go through to help address it. It's beautiful. I really can't recommend it enough. We're going to talk all about it. But Max, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Melanie. Yeah, you're one of the few people who've seen it at this point. And it's a project that I've been working on for a decade. It predates Genius Foods and pretty much anything else that I've done in the public sphere health-wise. And so, yeah, I'm just so excited to have it out into the world. And your feedback is just so wonderful to hear. So, yeah, thank you for that.
So actually, I had a moment with the film. So when I was watching it, my brain did something weird, because in the opening, credits and titles, there's a moment where it says Kathy Lugavere as mom. I don't know if I like looked away at that one second, but what I saw was like Kathy Lugavere, and I saw the word as and mom. And so in my head, I made a switch in my head, and I thought for a moment that it was a reenactment, that there was an actor playing Kathy, playing your mom. And so for the first like 10 minutes, I was like, this acting is incredible. I was like, this is next level. So then I stopped and I went and checked. And I was like, oh, this is real. And so then I was overwhelmed, honestly, like seeing that this was real life happening for you. So the timeline of that, how long did you shoot for?
I decided to do a documentary in late 2014. So that's obviously 10 years ago as we record this. But I've actually been kind of filming my mom my whole life. Like I've always been into self-documentation, and, you know, my family, we've always, you know, been lucky to have had the resources to have had, you know, early cameras, VHS cameras and the like. And so the film is peppered with footage that I've been shooting essentially my whole life. But when my mom became sick with this neurodegenerative condition in about 2011, it wasn't until 2014 that I decided that I wanted to make a documentary paying tribute to what it was that my mom was going through and you know, transmuting it into something that was meaningful for me as an artist. I felt like that was my way of taking something that was really awful that was going on in my life and turning it into something potentially, you know, purposeful and meaningful, and that could have some kind of social impact, you know, ability. In tandem with that, my mom loved, you know, being in front of the camera, and she was my biggest fan, and she would do anything to support, you know, any one of my cockamamie ideas at any given point. And, you know, she was fully gung-ho with it. And then the real catalyst was stumbling upon the research that these conditions are conditions that begin decades before the first symptom, and that there is a lot of research now going into our capacity to prevent them. And so for me, that was something that I felt really inspired to document and to do what I could to help move the needle on this disease. And I'm, you know, not a medical doctor, not an academic scientist, but this, for anybody who's, you know, at all familiar with my work, this documentary really does, it is the origin story. I mean, in the documentary, I'm not in any way an expert of any sort. I'm just a concerned son going on this journey of discovery to try to find answers.
I'm curious. Well, A, so when you decided, like you said, to actually make the documentary, was it like, did you have just a moment where you decided to do that, or was it a long mulling over process?
I mean, I had, what's the least boring way to tell this story? I started college on a pre-med track, and I ended up switching to a double major in film and psychology because I fell in love with filmmaking and storytelling in college. And in particular, I became really interested in documentary filmmaking because it was all done via digital, you know, with digital cameras, which allowed for an immediacy that traditional filmmaking, you know, disallowed because you had to measure lights and you had, you know, cutting film and changing cameras and all that stuff was just completely tedious to me. But documentary filmmaking, telling stories on the spot, to me was really compelling. And so I gravitated to that in college, and that led to me getting a job, which, you know, some people still remember me for. I was one of the main hosts for a TV network in the US that Al Gore co-founded called Current TV. And so on that network for 6 years, I was a, you know, I was a journalist, I was a presenter. I got to hone my storytelling and filmmaking chops. And so I've been working in media, and I'd been sort of, you know, doing mostly short form content. But, you know, when my mom became sick, I was in between jobs. I didn't really have a job at the time. And I just decided to, you know, what I kind of did an inventory. I took stock of my skills and my abilities, and I had media credentials. I was a quasi public figure, and I had this filmmaking, you know, background. So I decided what better way to make use of my college degree than to do what it was that I was trained to do, which was to investigate this topic of brain health and dementia for the sake of my own family, really. And my skills at the time, again, I wasn't a medical doctor. It was as a journalist, as an investigator of sorts. So I procured a camera and I started reaching out to scientists and experts around the world who responded to my email because they were super excited to be a part of a documentary that for the first time ever was talking about dementia through the lens of prevention. And I was, you know, I had been a public figure on TV. I wasn't famous, but I, you know, I was verified on Twitter. And so they, you know, I was able to get them to respond to my emails. And to me, that was just, it was very clear what I needed to do, you know, for me to have any impact on this condition, you know, for my mom, but also in terms of public health at large, which is something that I was really interested in doing, given my background as being a, you know, a public facing journalist. I thought this was for lack of a better term, a no-brainer for me to do. And so I got to work. And of course, you know, it was an incredibly arduous process. You know, making a feature-length documentary is incredibly difficult. I didn't know what I was signing up for at the time because this is my first time doing a feature-length doc. But now, 10 years later, it's, you know, I think the most important project I've ever done.
Hey, friends, I'm about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. And then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com.
And now I'm curious about the timeline, because when I watched it, I was assuming you had filmed all the footage with your mom, and then you had done all the interviews with the different experts now. Because it's a lot of people that my listeners will be familiar with that I've had on the show. So like Nina Teicholz, Dr. Perlmutter, Dr. Gundry, who I'm sure are all your friends now. So when did you interview them? Like now or?
No, these are all, every single interview in the film was done around 2015 to 2016.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And the science really hasn't changed all that much since then. I mean, it hasn't changed at all with regard to the actual information that's delivered in the film. But yeah, all of those interviews are done. Everybody in the film looks 10 years younger than they are now, because they were all these interviews.
I should have picked up on that.
Yeah. They were all done. I mean, myself included, you know, that it was all done. Yeah. About 10 years ago. And the interviewees, we have a really, I think, compelling blend of interviewees in the film where, you know, for an independent documentary like ours, it's incredible to me that we were able to get permission to go and film at Brown University, at Harvard, at Weill Cornell in New York City, at NYU Langone, where we shot a lot of the imaging stuff that we did with my mom. It's just incredible that we got those kinds of permissions. And we have researchers that are, you know, Ivy League, like the woman who, the neuropathologist, Suzanne Delamonte, who coined the term type 3 diabetes, is interviewed in my film. You know, it's the first time I've ever seen her in any kind of public facing media. She's a real scientist. And then in tandem with those researchers that we have had the privilege of including in the film, we also have, you know, physicians and health experts who are more public facing, you know, so that people, you know, can latch on to a familiar face, if you will, you know, like Dr. David Perlmutter, Nina Teicholz, Mark Hyman, and the like. And so I think it's cool that we have a blend of both. You know, we have these like incredibly legitimate, you know, bench researchers in the film. And then we also have, you know, experts in health who are, you know, who have built careers on the translational aspect of science, which again is, you know, just as important as the science itself. So yeah, it's a really cool film, but it's I don't want people, you know, one of the things that I think is really important, was important to me in going into this process of editing the film, I don't want people to think that it offers some kind of magical diet, you know, or some kind of silver bullet. This dementia is an incredibly complicated disease. And, you know, if people walk away, you know, with questions, you know, follow-up questions, I think that would be a real home run, you know, because there are no easy solutions. But, you know, I think one of the biggest take homes is that, you know, despite the fact that there is still so much left to learn, we don't have to sit idly, you know, as we await what's perhaps in our genetic conditions that we might be genetically at risk for. You know, these are conditions that are not determined by our genes. They're influenced, certainly, but we do have a say. And I think that's like the primary message that I wanted to convey with the film.
To that point, that was actually a major, major question I had for you about the film, because like I said, so much of it is this really personal, emotional journey that you have with your mom. I mean, we're basically just, you know, peering into your life and we're seeing what it's like to live with a loved one who has this cognitive decline. I'm so curious, when you had the idea, especially because how long it took for you to film this over, you know, over a decade, and to produce it and edit it and create it, how did you decide how much of the film you wanted to be that personal relationship with your mom versus how much you wanted it to be, you know, because you just said like, this is not a magic diet. There's not like a prescription here. So how much of it you wanted to be like the science and like teaching people versus the journey?
I think my views on that changed over the course of the production process. You know, going into it, I think I very much wanted it to be more of like a nutrition documentary. But then, you know, that was my goal 10 years ago, and it made a lot of sense for me at the time, having come off of the Al Gore project and, you know, and wanting to really kind of, you know, be more of the, you know, have more of a presence in the film as an investigator, because that was my job at the time. That's, you know, that made a lot of sense to me 10 years ago. But, you know, a lot, I think, has changed, both in terms of my perspective 10 years ago, but also the landscape in general. You know, we now live in a time where there are, you know, every other, you know, month, it seems like there's a new nutrition documentary coming out on these streaming platforms, and the vast majority of them are terrible. You know, the vast majority of them promote like seemingly a covert agenda, whether it be, you know, plant-based or what have you. The vast majority of them, actually, I mean, I would say that that's the agenda, just being fully transparent, like, you know, whether it's What the Health, The Game Changers, the recent Netflix twin study thing, You Are What You Eat. I mean, they're all terribly biased. And you know, and the truth is, it's really hard to convey the nuance of nutrition in a documentary and make it something that's actually compelling to watch. Nutrition is an incredibly complex science, and there are no easy answers. And, you know, at the end of the day, as a storyteller, I really did want to create a film that was share-worthy, you know, for it to make an actual impact and for people to, you know, for people who are experiencing what it is that me and my family experienced, you know, I want people to be able to watch it and feel less alone, you know, to find solace in what it was that my family went through. And so I think over the past 10 years, you know, and the production process generally, we really kind of skimmed back a lot of the more informational aspects of the film, even though it's definitely still there. And it's definitely, there's a lot there that, you know, people who are naive to this topic are going to gain a ton of value from. Certainly, I thought it was really important, more to, in the service of the audience, to provide a real raw and intimate window into what it's actually like to have dementia, both from the side of the patient as well as the caregivers and the family, because that's something that hasn't really been portrayed, I think, on film in a way, you know, that is really something that really captures what that experience is like. And I also wanted the film to be, at the end of the day, a love letter to my mom, who was the most important person in my life. And to, you know, to use my mom's story to make this, you know, this like just another nutrition film, I thought, you know, this film really has to be a tribute to what it was that my mom went through. And because she really is my inspiration, she is the inspiration behind everything that I do. And I wanted it to be a voice for her, you know, to speak to other families and, you know, other caregivers and other people with dementia, so as to, you know, so that people will feel less alone in that journey, because I know how I felt incredibly alone. And so we really wanted to make it about, you know, about my mom. She really is the star of the film, and I'm super proud of that. And in fact, she named the film.
Oh, she did.
Yeah, she, well, you probably remember a scene in the film where my mom is attempting to describe her inner world, and she alludes to these boxes remain empty. Boxes, you know, if you want to just, you know, for a second, consider all of your memories and all of the experiences that you've had, you know, piled into boxes, you know, and then suddenly those boxes, you go to check on them, and one day there's nothing to be found. My mom talks about that in the film, and she's struggling and suffering, but she references this idea of empty boxes. And my mom passed away in 2018, but, you know, as we were editing this film over the past 3 years, that line really stood out to my co-director in the project, Chris Newhard, and he brought it to the rest of the team, myself included. And he was like, what if this is the name of the film? You know, what if we let Kathy name the film? And we did. And I'm so glad that we did.
Because I remember that scene. It was really, really haunting. I thought you were saying that you had a conversation with your mom, that she knew you were making it, and she said that it should be called that. What I remember from that, I think it was the same scene. I was trying to remember the moments where you're talking to her and she's saying these things, and you would like repeat it back to yourself thinking about it. Because I think she made some other comment, not like about like a grandfather, in a person in the room or a man. I don't know. She was saying stuff and you were repeating it back to yourself. And what was so interesting about it, I personally don't have any family members who have had Alzheimer's. I did have my grandmother had cognitive decline. It was after a stroke though, and it was pretty fast. So it wasn't the long drawn out, experience that people often have with people like Alzheimer's. And to clarify, your mom had Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So is Lewy bodies a combination of those two essentially, or?
It has more in common with Parkinson's disease, but it's essentially like having Alzheimer's and Parkinson's at the same time in terms of the symptomology of the disease. Yeah.
Okay. And I remember she said in the film that it's almost like you expected her to be most stressed by the cognitive decline, but she made the comments about, the Parkinson's aspects being most troubling to her, at least, at one point.
Yeah, we've done, it's been really interesting. We've done a little theatrical tour of the film in the US, and it's been great to show the film to audiences in person. And one of the things that's really stood out from the Q&As that we've been having after the film is that many people with experience with Alzheimer's disease, a lot of the times the patient is unaware of the cognitive decline that they're experiencing, which I think in a way is a bit of a grace of sorts, in the sense that they're not fully aware of what it is they're experiencing, of what their loved ones are experiencing. But in the case of my mom, she was fully aware of the degree to which her cognition was being diminished. And, that was part of the reason why I think my mom was suffering to the degree that she was. And this is, documented in the film. And it's just a testament to, I guess, how different these dementias can be. But irrespective of the dementia diagnosis, once you've seen one case of dementia, you've seen one case of dementia. They're all so different. And that's something that I've learned from interacting with people who've gravitated to the film and who've seen the film and, who have had dementia in their family trees. It's so different. Yeah. I mean, I wish in a way my mom was less aware of what it was that she was going through, because she really did suffer. She saw her life, get just more and more diminished by the disease. And that's, I think, part of what made it so hard for me to experience, because my mom was somebody who had such an incredible zest for life. And to see that taken away from her by this condition was just, it was heartbreaking. And I'm just so glad that we've been able to capture it in little empty boxes, because there are probably millions of people out there like me, like her. And yeah, I just don't want people to feel alone in that process.
And to close out that loop on that scene I was talking about, I don't know what you were feeling during it, like when that moment happened or when you were editing it or, the whole journey of it all. But for me as a viewer, the way it made me feel was, because I just remember it's when she was talking about the little empty boxes and the things, and you kept repeating the words to yourself. And it's like you were searching for meaning in what she was saying. Like, is there meaning behind what she's saying? And it was this haunting feeling of, for me, not knowing, is there, like with the cognitive decline, is there meaning behind what they're saying? Like, what does it mean? Does it mean nothing? And it's just a very, I guess, a lonely feeling, like you were saying, to experience with another person. I'm curious with the turnaround, because she did, so in the film, you go through this journey with her, and then you do start implementing, like dietary changes, for example. And the scene when she's in the, it's not funny because I know she was not about it, but the scene when she was getting that scan that she didn't want to get for like an hour in the, it's really funny. She was not about it. Your relationship though with her is so, so sweet and so precious. Basically, she does not want to get this scan that she's worried about the radiation, which that's a tangent. Max encourages her to stay in it for like an hour, and she's just complaining and like, and then there's like 3 minutes left and she's like, I'm out. It's like, like, no, 3 minutes. No, she made it through. You do start implementing, these dietary changes and these different lifestyle changes with her from what you're learning. And there is a part where she seems to be doing a lot better. And I even noticed she's even like wearing more brightly colored clothing. I was wondering, did you like have her wear brightly colored clothing just to signify that? Or did that just happen naturally?
No, my mom was a fashionable woman. My mom, yeah, I didn't influence her wardrobe at all. My mom was, she loved to look good. And, it's just another aspect of how heartbreaking it all became when she, when that aspect of her life became compromised. But yeah, she was a classy woman from New York City and was in the garment business in New York. And yeah, she loved to wear nice things.
That's so incredible to hear. And because so much of it that I was watching, I was really curious how much of this, not that it was staged, but how much was, you know, your influence as a director and seeing this as a filmmaker versus just capturing literally what's happening in that moment. So that's really interesting to hear. So when you started implementing some changes with her, like dietary, light exercise, things like that, I mean, you guys thought about getting a puppy. Didn't quite manifest, right? You didn't get that dog, right?
No, we didn't.
Did these changes make a difference for her? And did it give you a sense of hope? Did it give you a sense of false hope when, you know, she did ultimately succumb to the disease? So just what was that part of the journey like for you?
Yeah, I mean, when I started doing all the research into diet and lifestyle, you know, I think we hear this term a lot on social media now, like the diet zealot, you know. And I think in my own family, there was a small window where I became a bit of a diet zealot, and I tried to dramatically uproot my mom's diet and change things as I saw fit from the literature that I was reading. And that didn't last very long, because I learned very soon that people live the way that they want to live, and this is an incredibly complex condition, and they're, you know, it's a condition that probably was simmering in my mom's body for years, if not decades, prior to the onset of symptoms. And you know, it's a condition that really does rob so much of a person's dignity and joy in life. And for me to come in and try to, you know, take away, for example, the confectionery products that brought my mom joy at that time in her life when she had become so limited in so many other ways, I just realized very early on that would have been a real dick thing to do. And I'm not that person. And I wouldn't want my mom to feel any bit of shame or guilt about, you know, the choices, the dietary choices that she would make. So, I mean, that's part of it, is that, you know, I learned very soon and early on that if I wanted to make any kind of dietary impact, I would just, you know, lead by example and try to share the insights that I was learning in a gentle way, but primarily to lead with love. And that's it, just to lead with love and to, you know, try to inspire change, you know, by living my life as an example. So that's pretty much it. And then, you know, also with dementia, what makes it even more difficult. So, I mean, you know, I'm sure you cover diet quite a bit on this show, as we all do, you know, anybody with a health podcast, and dietary change is incredibly difficult for anybody. You know, for somebody without dementia, dietary change is one of the most difficult things to achieve and sustain. And, you know, for somebody with dementia, that becomes exponentially more difficult. You know, for people with Alzheimer's disease, there's research that suggests that people with Alzheimer's disease actually begin to crave more sweet foods. And research is now emerging showing similarly that people with Parkinson's tend to consume more, you know, added sugar by at least 50% compared to healthy controls. So people, you know, as they get sick, they begin to crave, you know, sweeter foods. And, you know, who am I to stop my mom from consuming the kinds of things that she's craving? You know, I don't know. People listening to this might disagree with that, but it's just, you know, once you're actually in the trenches of chronic disease with a loved one, it's, you know, you have to, it's a really difficult tightrope to walk. And so I do think that one of the most productive changes that I encouraged my mom to make, and, you know, I'm not going to take full credit for this. My mom certainly, you know, she became aware early on of the benefits of exercise, and she started working out with a trainer, which is documented in the film as well. And I do think that that really helped my mom's spirits, if nothing else. But, you know, her mental health, you know, I think that definitely played a role in terms of stabilizing her mood. We know that exercise is one of the best things that you can do for conditions like Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, mild cognitive impairment. And so I do think that that was incredibly helpful to her. And she found a trainer who she really connected with, and she, you know, she continued to work out until the end.
I haven't aired it yet, but I recently interviewed Leroy Hood and Nathan Price. Leroy, he came up with a lot of the, he's one of the oldest guests I've had on the show. He came up with a lot of the science behind the Human Genome Project, which is really, really cool. Their new book is all about, it's called The New Age of Scientific Wellness, and it's about, you know, the future of health and everything. They really hone in on cognitive decline as, you know, the thing that people are most interested in with just finding answers. When they're looking at it in the book, they talk all about it being a metabolic disease and, you know, all of these different signs and implications and factors we see in Alzheimer's and cognitive decline and how they can potentially relate to metabolic issues in the brain. And you mentioned earlier in the show, one of the guests that you interviewed who coined the term type 3 diabetes. And now you're mentioning, you know, that your mom had all these sugar cravings and all these things. So with that aspect of diet, sugar, insulin, the brain, especially with all the research you've done for so many years, how much of that do you think is causative? Like with your mom, do you think it could have been another way if she had followed a completely different diet? I know this is a really hard question, but, and maybe it's, you know, too personal, but do you think it, like, she might have not experienced cognitive decline if she had lived a different lifestyle?
That's a great question. I'm happy to offer my thoughts. You know, one thing that I think is really a point that I think is really important to make, and I think made this in the film, is that, you know, my mom's diet could have had nothing to do with what it is that she developed. It could have played some role. It could have had everything to do with it. But at the end of the day, I'll never know. And, you know, there are so many factors that might play a role in initiating these kinds of conditions. You know, a topic that I've become increasingly interested in, and I was very honored to actually get to, I was invited recently to speak in DC at an event called the Brain and Environment Symposium. And, you know, now there's a lot of emerging research pointing to industrial pollutants, chemicals like certain pesticides, herbicides, chemical solvents as playing a role in mitochondrial dysfunction. So, you know, just because something is characterized as a metabolic disease doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, all fingers are pointing to diet. I mean, diet plays certainly a role. Statistically, you look around at the U.S. population, I mean, many people are in a state of metabolic distress, and that is largely, for most people, driven by, or at least contributed to, by diet. But, you know, we live in a world now where, you know, we're being exposed to innumerable pollutants that might play a role in damaging the mitochondria of the brain. There are compounds like, you know, paraquat, a pesticide, an herbicide, which is still being used in the United States, that, you know, is likely driving the skyrocketing rates of Parkinsonism that we're seeing now in the U.S. It's now the fastest growing brain disease. And my mom had a Parkinsonian condition. You know, other compounds like a chemical solvent that's now widely used in dry cleaning, or has been in the past, and now it's been supplanted by a related compound, is called trichloroethylene. And trichloroethylene, you know, epidemiologic studies, admittedly small, but suggest a sixfold increased risk of developing Parkinson's disease when people are exposed to trichloroethylene, which is a compound that easily can get into groundwater. It's a volatile organic compound, so it readily evaporates. It essentially poisons the air and, you know, even fatty foods in the vicinity in which, you know, it's been used. They've identified trichloroethylene in dairy products and dairy fat and butter and things like that. And my mom was somebody who worked in the garment center, you know, so I have no idea if my mom was ever exposed to trichloroethylene, but it's not hard to imagine a scenario where, you know, because of its use in industrial manufacturing and, you know, in textiles and the like, that my mom was at some point exposed. So, you know, there are so many different variables. I don't think that it's necessarily 100% diet, but I do think that insofar as we can kind of be mindful of this stuff and eat a diet that is, you know, maximally nutritious, I think that that probably is going to be helpful as well. The whole insulin thing is really interesting. And, you know, from my perspective, I think micromanaging insulin doesn't necessarily make a ton of sense as much as just, you know, eating in a state that keeps your body, you know, not overweight and well-muscled. I think that that's like the kind of like my general dietary perspective these days is making sure that you're, you know, metabolically healthy by optimizing for your muscle tissue, which is, you know, a lot of experts are now talking about. But, you know, that's something that my mom, from a dietary standpoint, my mom could have been better at, you know, optimizing for protein and things like that, which I'm happy to unpack if you'd like.
My listeners know, especially on the intermittent fasting podcast, I love the protein muscle topic. One quick question before that, had she and you and your family done genetic testing for variants that are risk factors?
Yeah, so great question. Neither Alzheimer's nor Parkinson's disease are predominantly heritable conditions. So the heritability of both of those conditions are very low. So Alzheimer's disease, you know, there is a well-defined Alzheimer's risk gene called the APOE4 allele. Both me and my mom carry one copy of the APOE4 allele, which puts us at increased risk. But about 1 in 4 people carry that. It's not a deterministic gene. 2-3% of Alzheimer's patients do inherit a mutation in a gene that essentially is considered deterministic, and it, you know, somebody might inherit early onset familial Alzheimer's disease, but that's a small minority of patients. So it's a largely non-heritable condition, but we have genetic risk factors, of course. And then with Parkinson's disease, the heritability is also very low. It's not thought to be a heritable condition. It's thought to be an environmental condition. In fact, a neurologist, a University of Rochester neurologist and researcher, Ray Dorsey, who is he's doing incredible work. I've had him on my podcast, and he was actually the organizer of the symposium that I spoke at in DC. He calls Parkinson's disease and Lewy body dementia man-made conditions. And I think that's just a striking way to think about it. And I don't disagree based on the research that I've seen that he's helped to bring to light.
And that deterministic gene that, you know, like 2-3% of the patients do have, do they know like what the mechanism of action that happens there is? I just feel like there'd be so much to learn from that.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's been a while since I've looked, but it's either due to an overproduction of amyloid beta, which is this protein that aggregates and clumps and forms the plaques associated with Alzheimer's disease. So it's like it's basically a mutation that causes this overproduction of this, you know, plaque in the brain. And it might also impact clearance. So, you know, there's the issue of overproduction or an inability to properly clear these proteins, which we all build in our brains, but, you know, we do generally have the ability to clear them. So it's a mutation. It's a pathologic genetic mutation. It's not a SNP, you know, it's not like one of these single nucleotide polymorphisms like the APOE4 allele, which is not a mutation. It's actually a normal genetic variant. The early onset familial variant of Alzheimer's disease is due to a mutation. So that is no bueno. And it's comparable, I guess, to familial hypercholesterolemia, where people will like either overproduce or underclear, you know, this lipoprotein that can become potentially atherosclerotic. So it's kind of similar. It doesn't reflect sporadic Alzheimer's disease, like the neuropathology of sporadic Alzheimer's disease, even though they're related by way of this protein, this, you know, this amyloid beta protein that they both have in common, they're completely different animals. And so that's why I think it's really important that people are mindful of that, you know, the vast majority of what's called late onset Alzheimer's disease is not a deterministic, it's not a condition that's predetermined by your genes.
I was literally just thinking how that sounds analogous to like the hypercholesterolemia, the familial, oh my goodness, use your words. But it's interesting because in that comparison, because there's so much debate about LDL and, you know, how problematic is it and, you know, what's the role of context and all these things. That said, you know, you can have the situation like that word I can't say, familial hypercholesterolemia, where there's going to be, you know, a lot more of it. And that does seem to be an issue. And then kind of similarly to the amyloid plaque, there's so much debate about the amyloid plaque, especially now. And actually, that was one of the most mind-blowing things that I learned reading Nathan and Lee's book that I mentioned earlier, was they were talking about how, you know, some of the amyloid plaque may actually and I don't remember the entire science, what they were saying, but it actually might be protective in what it's doing, which was fascinating to think about. So there's all this debate. I'm curious what you think about the progression of the medication industry with all of that, and especially the drama that has come out sort of, I mean, semi-recently with, you know, this idea that maybe a lot of these Alzheimer's trials and these drugs were not what people were thinking. What do you think about that industry? You do make the comment in the film, and this was a while ago, obviously, when it happened, when you're with your mom, but you make a comment about how you were like weighing the cost benefit of her being on all these different drugs and that versus quality of life. I feel like that's a really hard decision that a lot of people have to decide. So where do you fall on, because I just said a lot of stuff, where do you fall on the history of and where we currently are with the medications to address this?
Yeah, I mean, that's an important question because it's, you know, I'm not anti-pharma. If there was a drug that I could give my mom that was going to provide some kind of symptomatic relief for her, I would in a heartbeat have, you know, ran to my local pharmacy and had that prescription filled, but there was nothing. And nonetheless, by the end of my mom's life, she was on 14 different pharmaceuticals. So it's just crazy to me that this is allowed, you know, and the drugs are minimally effective. I think that, you know, from a treatment standpoint, it's very unlikely that we're going to see a drug. I mean, you know, I'd like to hold out hope, but it's very unlikely that we're going to see a drug that is, you know, disease modifying and even symptomatically effective for a condition that begins decades prior to the first symptom. I mean, here's the thing. Once you're diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease or any other form of dementia, you're essentially in the late stage of that disease. You know, whether or not you were just diagnosed yesterday, I mean, these are conditions that they're diseases of midlife with symptoms that emerge in late life. But these are conditions that begin far earlier than the presentation of symptoms. And that's why the idea that we're going to have some kind of magical drug come along is just like, it's very unlikely. And that's why we need to really continue beating the drum about prevention and how important it is to be mindful of these different variables and to clean up our world, essentially, you know, in a way that makes this effort less effortful, because it is a lot today to be mindful of these industrial toxicants and, you know, our diets, which, you know, I mean, I'm just like everybody else in that, you know, my food environment is 73% processed, just like it is yours. And so, you know, there is a lot, but yeah, the drug stuff is really disheartening, and there's a lot of fraud in the industry, as we've seen recently with regard to Alzheimer's disease drugs in particular. And it's, I think, because amyloid beta, which has been the target for drug discovery for so many decades, as you alluded to, you know, it's not the bad guy. There is evidence to support that it's actually it plays a potentially protective role in the brain. Similarly to LDL cholesterol, you know, like we think LDL, these LDL lipoproteins are the boogeyman, right? That they're, you know, inherently atherosclerotic. They're not. I mean, they're potentially atherosclerotic for certainly, you know, but our bodies are making these compounds for a reason. And with amyloid beta, there's this idea that it is, you know, it's there to play a protective role. Its production seems to be upregulated in the presence of certain viruses during states of inflammation and the like. And the problem is that when it overaggregates and it forms these, you know, these misfolded proteins that then clump and become less easy for the body to dissolve and wash away, that's when it becomes, you know, problematic. But what's causing the amyloid to be there to begin with? You know, like what's causing it to, you know, to form these clumps and to aggregate? Is it poor sleep? Is it shitty diet? Is it, you know, is it mitochondrial dysfunction due to exposure to these, you know, these environmental pollutants? I mean, there's a lot of questions that need to be asked, but the latest research published by The Lancet in 2020 identified at least a dozen modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's disease, you know, being type 2 diabetic, having hypertension, chronic depression, social isolation, hearing loss, hypertension. These are all risk factors that are modifiable and might play a role in keeping, you know, your brain free of this amyloid plaque decades before it would otherwise emerge. So Yeah. So I don't think that amyloid is the boogeyman. I mean, certainly in the late stage of the disease, it's problematic. And by then it might be too late because we have drugs that are now very effective at clearing amyloid from the brain. And they don't seem to be clinically meaningful from the standpoint of improving the symptoms, right? Like aducanumab, you know, this monoclonal antibody, which was approved despite, you know, lots of pushback by the FDA. It was fast-tracked for approval because it was so great at clearing the brain of amyloid. Of course, it led to, you know, side effects and even a death in those early clinical trials. But it was great at clearing the brain of amyloid, nonetheless provided minimal, you know, improvement in terms of the cognitive, you know, features of the patients, you know, to which the drug was given. And very recently, just over the past couple of months, the FDA or Biogen actually said that they were pulling the drug. They were stopping, you know, their support for it. And yeah, so it's just crazy. And that's why I think, like, you know, we should do our best to minimize risk. And, you know, and you know, at the end of the day, you could do everything right and you could still develop dementia. I mean, that's really the tragedy of the disease. But I think, like, we do have a degree of agency and we shouldn't feel hopeless. There are things that we can do. And having hope, I think, is so incredibly important.
Hi, friends. Would you like to have the most epic eating experience? I'm talking eradicate bloating and better absorb your nutrients. If so, you need digestive enzymes. These are one of my most favorite supplements out of everything I take, and I truly cannot imagine my life without them. Digestive enzymes are key to break down your food into usable nutrition and to stop things like bloating, digestive distress, constipation, all the things. That's why I created Avalon X Digest. And you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us. You can also get a subscription and save 15%, which you can pause or cancel at any time. Friends, I worked so hard to create the perfect blend of enzymes for Avalon X Digest. It's a full-spectrum, plant-based enzyme blend with proteases to help you break down protein, amylase for carbs, lipase for fats, cellulase for fiber, and so much more. In fact, there are 13 different types of enzymes in this blend. I cannot tell you how many people have told me that when they take Avalon X Digest, they experience no digestive distress with meals. These are truly game changers. And for any of you guys looking to up your protein intake, Avalon X Digest will help you actually break down and assimilate your protein so you get more protein from your meals. I wanted to create the highest potency enzymes so that you get all of these benefits when you eat with no problematic fillers or ingredients. Avalon X Digest is also tested multiple times for purity and potency, comes in glass bottles, and is truly the best enzymes on the market. And again, you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us.
Oh, I think it's so, so important. And speaking of how, you know, how it can happen either way, and then you mentioned like the word too late. If a person does start exhibiting symptoms of cognitive decline, is there like and you said earlier that every case is different with the way it presents, but do you feel like if people start making changes like right at the beginning that there is a lot more hope? Like, so basically how much hope is there based on where a person is at and their symptoms? And is there always like a point in time when it's just too late?
I think that if you can take a kitchen sink approach and start exercising, you know, regularly, and I'm talking about, you know, light cardiovascular activity to support your cardiovascular system, but also resistance training is really, really important. I think if you can do that, and if you can start eating a healthful, protein-rich diet that's high in healthful sources of, you know, fat, like omega-3 fatty acids, which are really important to the brain, rich in antioxidants, devoid of, you know, industrial additives and chemicals and pollutants, rich in foods like dark leafy greens, which provide, you know, a number of important benefits to the cardiovascular system, to brain health specifically. I think that you might potentially be able to improve symptoms, slow the progression of the disease. But it's important to be clear that nobody's ever survived Alzheimer's disease. You know, these are conditions that we have not been able to reverse them just yet. So I do think that by, you know, if I were to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease one day, or Parkinson's, or Lewy body dementia, I would likely try for myself a ketogenic diet, I'm not saying that a ketogenic diet is a cure for this condition, but there is some research on that. I mean, ketogenic diets dramatically change brain energy metabolism and supply the brain with an energy substrate that it can continue to use even when it's struggling to create energy out of glucose, which is its normal primary energy substrate. Dom D'Agostino talks a lot about this. You know, he's a researcher in the field. So I would probably try that, a ketogenic diet. I wouldn't, you know, I don't, it's not a, it's certainly not a cure, but the earlier you adopt one, there seems to be an effect in terms of improving quality of life and the like. But yeah, I don't, you know, I think prevention really is crucial. And, you know, once you're diagnosed, I think there are certainly things that you can do. Absolutely. You know, particularly when, you know, earlier on. So for example, if you have mild cognitive impairment, you know, making sure that you're getting your blood pressure into a healthy state, making sure that you're optimizing your hormones with resistance training. And, you know, if you're a female, maybe even HRT, you know, Lisa Moscone, who's an interviewee in my film, she does a lot of incredible research and advocacy for women on the value of HRT in the right setting, you know, which is something that I think there's still a lot of confusion about, and I'm by no means an expert in that topic, but, you know, but it seems to be the case that the benefits outweigh the risks for, you know, for most women with that regard. And women are at higher risk for developing dementia, you know, double the risk as compared to men. And so I think, you know, that could be a potentially disease modifying, or not disease modifying, but a potential effective prevention strategy. You know, more research. We need to do more research on that. But I think at the end of the day, there are a lot of things that you can do, whether you have it or not. It's just important to be clear about what the potential and the, you know, what we currently know and what we don't know and the like. Because giving, you know, anybody false hope, that's not my goal. But there is a lot that we can do, and I think that's important.
I'm fascinated by the HRT thing. I do think that there's a lot of, like you said, confusion out there, and that a lot of fear mongering surrounding like the Women's Health Initiative and the findings from that, which were not quite, I don't think, communicated properly based on the actual risks from that. Why do you think, though, cognitive decline and dementia and everything is more common in women? Do you have any theories?
Well, I think estrogen normally plays a protective role. And I think, you know, during that menopausal shift, it's like the rug being pulled out from beneath your feet. And then you throw into the mix everything else that every human being is suffering from, metabolic dysfunction and the like. And I think it creates a perfect storm. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much my read on the situation. I think like if you're female and I'm not a woman. I don't know what it's like to be a woman, but I think from my purely anecdotal vantage point, you know, it's like, it's only recently that women are really starting to embrace resistance training and, you know, that this whole myth about, you know, weight training making you bulky I think the wellness industry, we're doing a pretty good job, I think, of debunking that silly myth. And I think I'm seeing a lot more women embracing resistance training and how valuable that is from the standpoint of metabolic health. But who knows, maybe this is something that, you know, and also women might have tended to undereat protein in the past. You know, I know steak and foods like that are considered more manly, and, you know, people like yourself, like Gabrielle Lyon, like others are really doing a great job speaking to women about how important it is to optimize for protein in their diet. But I don't know, maybe historically women have just underconsumed protein and they haven't really embraced resistance training as much as they now are. And maybe that, you know, you throw that into the milieu of this menopausal shift and all of the ultra processed foods that we're all generally over consuming, and it just creates this perfect storm. So that would be my hypothesis.
And women, I don't know the data, but women do live longer. So it's possible, or does it not line up?
They don't live long. They don't live so much longer that would
Be a fact. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I mean, these are conditions that begin in midlife essentially. So it's not a function of lifespan. It'd be great if we could chalk it up to that. You know, that's an easy answer, but
one last question about the keto diet thing. where do you stand on like supplementing that with MCT oil or coconut oil? Does that seem to have an added benefit?
You know, there's very limited research on that. I would freaking try it if I was ever diagnosed. Mary Newport is a physician who has done a lot of advocacy on behalf of medium chain triglycerides. And there actually is an FDA approved food product on the market called Axona, which is based on, MCTs. So hell yeah, I would try it. But the research on MCTs are not super exciting, unfortunately. Like there's not a lot of really compelling stuff there. It's, you know, certainly not a cure, but the whole mechanism by which they may work is by supplementing the brain with an energy substrate, ketones, which the brain research suggests will continue to use as a fuel source, even when suffering from Alzheimer's disease, which actually creates glucose, the state of glucose hypometabolism in the brain. So the brain essentially in Alzheimer's disease, it struggles to make energy from glucose, which is its normal fuel source, but its ability to generate energy from ketone bodies is largely unperturbed. And so that's why there's this thinking that you can essentially, keep the lights on in the brain by supplying it with ketone bodies, which the brain will happily use as a fuel source. Up to 60% of the brain's, energy requirement can be furnished by, medium chain, by ketone bodies, which when you consume MCTs, you're essentially supplying your body with ketone bodies. And there's now a bunch of other, ketone products on the market, which may play a role. There's virtually no, research on them. But like, trust me, if I was suffering from Alzheimer's disease, I have no affiliation. There's a company called HVMN. I've worked with them in the past as a sponsor. So they've sponsored my podcast in the past, but I'm currently not, I don't work with them currently and I have no, vested interest in the company or anything like that, but they make like a ketone IQ product or something like that, which I'm not endorsing, but like if I had this condition, this is not an ad for them, but it's like a pure ketone. I would probably try something like that. And I would just see if it did anything, I don't know if it would do anything, but like, I would try anything.
It's like ketone esters.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I find it so fascinating. I find it really interesting that there's not more studies on it. Just because, like you said, since it is a fuel that the brain can immediately use and bypass that whole glucose issue, it seems really promising. But I guess there's still the glass ceiling or the issue that the brain does require a portion of glucose. So it's not like you could completely switch over, which would be nice.
Well, that's fine because glucose is, our bodies are very efficient at using glucose as a fuel source. The problem is like when you're insulin resistant in your body, the degree of insulin resistance in the body correlates inversely with, or actually it correlates positively with the degree of starvation that your brain is experiencing. So, somebody who's more insulin resistant is going to have a higher degree of glucose hypometabolism in their brains. So, you want to make sure that your body is insulin sensitive and not being over fat. That's, I think, a great, great way to make sure that you're supporting your body's insulin sensitivity, resistance training regularly, avoiding exposure to, these plastic compounds, which might play a role in increasing insulin resistance.
Doesn't the same enzyme that degrades insulin also degrade, is it amyloid, or isn't it the same enzyme in the brain that does both?
Yeah. And you brought this up on our first interview and I was super impressed, but it's a insulin degrading enzyme in the brain. It breaks down amyloid and keeps it soluble so that it can be flushed away, but it also breaks down insulin in the brain, which is an interesting mechanism. I'm not, 100% sure that we fully know how those two, how that enzyme interacts with both insulin and amyloid, but it stands to reason that, the more insulin, you have in circulation, the more, that enzyme is going to focus primarily on breaking down and clearing insulin.
Controversial question, maybe a little bit. So I remember last time that I had you on, around the same time, I also had on the Scherzeis from Loma Linda. They wrote a book. They wrote Alzheimer's Solution, I think. So they're very vegan. very vegan. And they have a whole, you know, book about a vegan plant-based diet for reversing cognitive decline or preventing. I don't know what words they use exactly. My question here, this question haunts me. This question speaks to a larger question I have about this show in general, because on this show, I bring on people of completely opposite perspectives and not people that I definitely don't always completely agree with the perspectives, but I think it's really valuable to expose people to all different viewpoints. And if I don't, you know, talk to the other side, it helps with me feeling like I'll be less biased in my own perspective. So my question here is, do you think, especially because you were talking about how there's all these different lifestyle factors that are potentially playing a role in this issue of cognitive decline, if a person has not tried dietary changes for their Alzheimer's or whatever they have, and then their exposure to that concept of like cleaning up their diet comes through like the plant-based world or the vegan world, do you think that's doing more harm than good? Is it doing good because they are, you know, cleaning up their diet and putting a focus on diet? I'm just really curious the benefit versus the harm of people being exposed to things like a plant-based and vegan diet that's, you know, whole foods based for dementia and cognitive decline.
Yeah. Well, the question you always have to ask is what are we comparing this dietary pattern to? If we're comparing it to the standard American diet, I would say it's a healthy alternative, you know, to the standard American diet. If we're comparing, you know, a plant-heavy vegan diet to a plant-heavy diet that also includes grass-fed red meat and eggs and wild fatty fish, do I think that that's optimal? I would say absolutely not. I think, you know, incorporating animal source foods like grass-fed beef, eggs, fish, even certain dairy products, if you're not sensitive to it, I think that is far superior than a diet that excludes those products. And so I think veganism is the wrong approach. I think, you know, at the very least, you know, even the most nutritionally orthodox expert will acknowledge that there's good evidence on fatty fish, the benefits of fatty fish for brain health. But even eggs, you know, even my advocates for the Mind diet, you know, Martha Claire Morris, she was one of my first guests on my podcast. She was a huge fan of eggs and all of their nutritional value. So yeah, I'm not of the opinion that the vegan diet is optimal. Is it better than the standard American diet? Sure. Does it reduce risk for cardiovascular disease and other conditions compared to the standard American diet? Sure. Do I think it's better than a diet that is just as high quality but inclusive of animal source foods? No, I think, you know, including animal source foods is the way to go for sure.
I do have somebody who thinks, a vegan who thinks the fatty fish is not the way to go. I'm currently prepping to interview Dr. Michael Greger. Have you had him on your show?
Yeah, he's so well known as being like a vegan, you know, biased vegan covert activist. And I think it's fine to be an activist. It's fine to ethically decide to abstain from animal source foods. I think that's fine. But it's just my problem is when these people convolute their message with health messaging, which is inaccurate and pseudoscientific. And Michael Greger pushes a lot of pseudoscience. I mean, there's some stuff that he talks about that's great and accurate, but he peddles a lot of like really what I think is like really bad misinformation at times. And even vegans, like within the vegan community, will agree with that. So I'm not, you know, I don't like trash talking anybody because look, we're all just trying to help people and do our best in this crazy life. But yeah, I think veganism is suboptimal. You can say, look, our oceans are polluted, fish contain microplastics and whatever, but you know, veganism is a nutrient depleted diet. Veganism doesn't contain preformed omega-3s, which I think are really important. You know, there's myriad nutrients, which we know that animal source foods contain that you can't get on a plant-based diet. And at the end of the day, protein, I think, is a really important macronutrient to prioritize in your diet for the maintenance of your musculature, for all of the other really important nutrients that tend to cohabitate. Protein, in the food environment. And if you're demonizing whole foods today in a time when 60% of the calories that your average person consumes comes from ultra processed foods, to demonize a whole food like red meat, eggs, things like that, you're just, I think it's like the wrong message. So that's just, yeah, that's my perspective. And also there's no evidence that veganism prevents dementia or protects, you know, the brain in any capacity. There's just no evidence there. It's just like, you know, this fringe concept cobbled together by lots of epidemiology, which is notoriously weak in the field of nutrition. And I just think it's a huge missed stake, no pun intended.
Hi, friends. Out of all of the incredible biohacking devices that I use to optimize my health and wellness, there is one type of biohacking device that I have been using the longest. We are talking every single day of my life because it radically changes my life that much. It helps my energy levels, my sleep, my anxiety, so many things. You might know what it is. It is the category of blue light blocking glasses. I just found an upgraded form of this, which does so much more than just block blue light. There's a company called Hyperlite Optics. They've been established in Europe for years and are just now coming to the US. And here's what makes their glasses so special. You might have heard me talk about C60 on the show before. Hyperlite Optics actually uses patented Swiss technology with fullerene C60 as a quantum light transformer. Basically, they transform bad light into healthy, beneficial light. As light passes through the lenses, the fullerene actually twists at a near inconceivable 18 billion times per second, altering photon orientation. So this takes problematic wavelengths of light that we're exposed to in our modern environment and transforms it into healthy light. They are the ultimate ideal form of blue light blocking glasses. And they come in the coolest styles ever. These are truly luxury glasses. They are such high quality. I have never found blue light blocking glasses like this before. They're truly right up there with all those fancy name brands people are tempted to buy. Prepare yourself to get a lot of compliments. Plus, unlike normal blue light blocking glasses, which you might just wear at night, you can wear these all the time. In the morning, the afternoon, the evening, inside, outside. You can turn every moment that you look at the world into a therapeutic experience for your eyes. They're great to use at the computer. They'll reduce your eye strain, headaches, fatigue. You can wear them at night to regulate your circadian rhythm, especially if you're looking at devices, and you will sleep so much better. And did I mention they have so many styles and look so cool? By the way, if you want the model that you've probably seen me wearing a lot on social media, those are the Eclipse Blue model. And like I said, they are new to the US and I have one of the only discount codes available. You can get 10% off one pair of Hyperlite, 15% off two pairs, and 15% off all future purchases once you buy one pair with the coupon code Melanie10 at hyperliteoptics.com/Melanie. That's right, 10% off one pair, 15% off two or more pairs, and 15% off all future purchases with the coupon code Melanie10, M-E-L-A-N-I-E 10, at hyperliteoptics.com/Melanie.
I mean, that kind of all, it touches on a lot of things I was talking about, because like I said, I'm reading his book right now. It's called How Not to Age. It's very long, as his books often are. And he references like a ton of studies. So it feels very scientific. But then if you go look at the studies, I just feel like there's a lot of careful, you know, plugging and playing and potential cherry picking of everything. And then I, you know, get haunted. I'm like, should I even be having this conversation on the show? But I do learn a lot and I do have a lot of questions. So it's a whole thing.
Yeah, he's definitely put out some factual stuff. I mean, but that's kind of how the bait and switch maneuver works. You know, you put out like, you know, two factual statements and you follow, you know, to build trust, and then you follow it up with something that's like just completely inaccurate. You know, like I think I've read some stuff from him that I've, you know, integrated, and I've checked out the studies, and, you know, whenever he's talking about the benefits of certain plants, I think that's when he's doing a benefit to society, right? Like, stick to that, you know, like tell me about how, you know, just eating a handful of Brazil nuts, you know, can help improve like lipid homeostasis in the body, or how sulforaphane is this, you know, really interesting potential cancer fighter found in cruciferous vegetables. Like all that stuff is great. Like that's all adding, I think, positively to the discourse on nutrition. But then when, you know, these vegan activists fearmonger animal source foods, I think that's the real harm. And I think it does real harm because it dissuades people from eating foods that are incredibly healthful. You know, I can't tell you how many, you know, women, for example, follow me and who, you know, who've read my books and have started eating, you know, they've been on plant-based diets for 7 years and they finally started eating red meat again and they got their periods back and their brain fog has lifted and their, you know, and their depression has improved. And like, and I just think it's, you know, we're adapted to be omnivores. We can argue about the appropriate proportions of, you know, the different food groups in our respective diets, but we know that protein is essential. We know that we have an essential need for certain fats, which are found primarily in animal source foods. And, you know, and so like to fearmonger and to encourage people to take these foods completely off their plate, I think does real harm and it pisses me off. But, you know, just me being passionate.
What's weird about it is like, if you just subjectively look at, because they always reference the blue zones and the longest lived populations. But if you look at that objectively, the majority of them all have animal products in the diet. So if you were to just like completely objectively say, what is the best diet for longevity? It would be inclusive of animal foods based on that logic.
Yeah, blue zones advocate, they misrepresent the diets. Like in Okinawa, they eat tons of pork. In, you know, in Ikora, Greece, they eat tons of lamb. They drink goat milk and stuff like that. You know, I mean, go to any region in the Mediterranean, they're eating prosciutto. Where do you think we get these delicacies from, you know? And so to mischaracterize the diets of these long-lived people, look, I mean, you referenced some doctors from the Loma Linda, you know, health system. Loma Linda is a Seventh-day Adventist health system. Anybody who comes out of that system is going to have a bias towards veganism and vegetarianism, but primarily veganism, because that religion eschews the consumption of animal products. Most people, you know, to be pious and virtuous in that religion are vegan. And we know that social connection and all that stuff are really important when it comes to longevity. So, you know, their longevity has little to do with their vegan diets and mostly, you know, to do with the fact that it's this tight-knit community. But pretty much any data to come out of that system and any quote-unquote expert to come out of that system, you can bet money that they're biased. That system, you know, the Loma Linda, the Seventh-day Adventists also even have their own medical journal. They even have their own health journal, and all the research that they publish is pretty much like anti-animal source foods. But they're not forthcoming with that bias. Yeah, a lot of the nutrition research, and which is why it's so annoying, because nutrition is such a, I love nutrition, but so much of the research is so incredibly weak. It's all predicated on nutritional epidemiology, which there is some value to it. I mean, it's meant to be hypothesis generating. But by and large, you know, there are so many problems with nutrition epidemiology. When you look at the population level at people who consume meat, for example, people who consume meat tend to smoke more. They tend to drink more alcohol. They tend to be more sedentary. And that's why you tend to see, you know, meat associated with poor health outcomes. You know, it's not surprising that meat consumption is so consistently correlated with worse health outcomes, because there are all these confounding variables. And nutrition researchers can't possibly adjust for all those different potential confounders. And then you take the fact that, you know, how reliable even are those associations when they're assessed by way of these food frequency questionnaires, which are administered generally like once a year, asking you to, over the past year, how much meat did you consume? You know, like they're notoriously unreliable. So you get that thrown into the mix. And then you throw into the mix the fact that the effect sizes themselves are so incredibly small that it's like you'd have to be a fool to assume that that's a causal connection, right? What needs to be done are long-term randomized controlled trials where you put people, you know, on diets that are of sufficiently high quality equated actually for quality. And you've got, you know, you take one group that's on essentially a purely plant-based diet, and you take another group that's on a plant-based diet or a plant-forward diet with, you know, with lots of animal source foods, and you see who does better. And you don't just look at, you know, LDL cholesterol, which might be higher in the group that's consuming meat, because that's not a clinical outcome. That's a biomarker, right? And so that these are all the ways in which nutrition science is skewed. And I think it's really problematic. And nonetheless, these are the kinds of studies that are used to, you know, to sway public purchasing, you know, consumer behavior, used to create careers in the field of nutrition and so much more. And it's just like, you know, my whole thing is helping people, you know, just see the truth of it all and make better decisions for themselves. And it's not like I'm promoting any one magical diet. I just, you know, my whole thing is people should be eating animal source foods and they should be eating plants. And that's it. End of conversation. The more whole foods you can eat, the fewer ultra processed foods you can eat, the better off you're going to be.
Yeah, I really don't think we can escape the implications of the healthy user bias with all of this. And it's kind of like, do you remember, it was sort of recently, that fasting study that came out? Speaking of, you're talking about food frequency questionnaires. I bet you saw it. It was where they said that intermittent fasting was causing cardiovascular disease. And the setup of the study, I can't even like say it. It's so awful. They looked at data of people saying what they ate on like two different days over years. And then they applied that. They were like, oh, that's what they're doing fasting wise. And then they applied that to, I think, like the next, I don't know, 8 years or so. And then they drew conclusions about outcomes from that based on like two surveys of what people were eating on 2 days. I don't even know how that even got slightly, potentially, barely greenlit. It just doesn't make any sense. But do you practice intermittent fasting?
I don't really so much anymore. I think it's really important to eat, you know, a hefty bolus of protein soon after you wake up. I try not to eat too late at night. So I guess that's my way of practicing it. I try not to eat for 2 to 3 hours before bed because, you know, circadian biology is showing us that we're really meant to eat earlier in the day and to not eat too close to bedtime because that's when our sort of metabolic faculties start to wind down. So I don't, you know, that's pretty much the extent of it. I don't like have a goal of like, I've got to spend 16 hours every day or, you know, what is it? 16 hours. Yeah. Fasting. I've got to like hit my 16-hour target every day. I definitely don't think about it in terms of like, you know, a fasting and feeding window. I just, you know, try to eat, you know, like when I usually will get hungry, like 30 to 45 minutes after I wake up. And that's generally like, I like to work out in the morning. So I'll eat something before I work out, like a protein forward meal. And then I eat a big dinner, generally around 7 to 8 PM. And I generally won't eat, you know, after that. That's pretty much it. And so that gives me, you know, a good 10 hours of fasting. I don't obsess too much over the, you know, number of fasting hours or anything like that. I just don't think it's that important.
For the protein, because, you know, we've talked a lot about the role of protein for how important it is. What amount do you recommend? Do you think there's an upper limit? I always wonder if I'm eating too much protein. I eat a shockingly large amount of animal protein.
Yeah, there doesn't really seem to be an upper limit. I mean, the upper limit would be the upper limit would be if you're eating so much protein that it because and protein is so satiating that it's disallowing you from eating other foods, you know, there is a limit at which point, you know, eating too much protein, the body doesn't really derive all that much energy from protein. And so you know, there's this whole phenomenon known as rabbit starvation, where, you know, if you're not eating enough fat and you're not eating any carbohydrates and you're just eating too much protein, like your body will effectively starve to death. You know, a lot of these like feeding studies with protein, you know, the upper limit is like 40% of calories from protein. So that would be what I would consider to be like the general upper limit. And there's really no need to consume more protein than, you know, maybe 1 gram per pound of body weight from a body composition standpoint and muscle maintenance standpoint. But yeah, I mean, my target is generally, you know, I try to get 1.6 grams of protein times my weight in kilograms. That's what the research suggests as being, you know, the target that you want to hit to optimize your muscle. And I, you know, spend a lot of time resistance training, and, you know, I want to keep my gains as long as I can. And so I'm trying to get, generally for me, I'm about 195 pounds right now. I don't know, something like 160 grams of protein a day. So if you divide that over four meals, for me, that's like 40 grams of protein per meal, which is a pretty easy lift for me, for somebody my size. So yeah, I try to hit that protein target every day. And then, you know, protein is so satiating. So for people who are like, you know, most people are trying to lose weight, I recognize that. But if you're trying to gain weight, you know, there is some value potentially in eating a little bit less protein to make, again, room for more energy, for more carbs and fats.
It's funny because people often ask me, they always want to know what I'm eating. I'm like, don't ask me, because like, I eat a lot of protein. So bringing things, because this has been absolutely so amazing, bringing things back to the film, how we were, you know, the purpose of today's conversation. I'm really curious. So how do you feel about it? What is the reception been? Because you mentioned in the beginning, you know, what you're really hoping to accomplish with the film. How do you feel with everything now that it's, and congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. It feels incredibly cathartic. You know, it's been a 10-year journey, and I'm just so excited for people to see it. I mean, I'm excited for people to see it because I think it's a really moving piece. It's the most important thing I've ever done. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of people going through this. About 6 million people in the United States alone have Alzheimer's disease. About 1.2 million have Parkinson's disease. There are other forms of dementia, and it's a really alienating condition. And, you know, insofar as my film presents a true portrait of what it's really like, both from the patient and caregiver side, I think, you know, that's a tremendous value add to anybody who's going through this. And, you know, selfishly, I'm just excited that my mom will get to live on in the hearts and minds of the people who choose to watch the film. There's also some really great, you know, research in there. So for anybody interested in, you know, a broad strokes picture on what you might do to potentially prevent dementia, I think it's a great starting place to, you know, to instigate further inquiry. But yeah, you know, this has been a labor of love. And there were many times over the past 10 years where I thought it was never going to see the light of day, where I thought it was just a failure. And it was really painful for me, actually. But the fact that it's now finished, and on June 27th at littleemptyboxes.com, we're going to have it, you know, out for all the world to see. That to me is just, it's just an incredible, yeah, it's not something I take lightly. And I can't wait to get the response from it, you know, and see how people, you know, resonate with it. That to me is going to be really cool, because, you know, it's a it's been a labor of love, to say the least.
I can really tell. And like we were talking about in the beginning, I think it really is the perfect blend of being just this really haunting, riveting story. Your mom is just so riveting. Like, she's so everything she... like the way she sees the world and the way, and the things she says, and she's like just funny and fascinating, and seeing your bond with her and you care for her, and also the struggles that you go through, you know, just trying to find answers. I just feel like it's going to resonate with so many people. And then it provides, you know, just the right amount of all of this science and things that, like, we've been talking about on today's show to get people, give people implementable things that they can do now. And also, I think, really make people curious, so that they'll, you know, walk away with more questions and wanting to seek more answers, which then it's just unending the amount of information people can find when they're on that journey. Is it in theaters? Is it in some theaters right now?
Yeah. So we did a theatrical release in the US in select theaters. And so, yeah, I believe it's still currently playing in a handful of theaters, but we obviously want everybody in the world to be able to see it. So that's why we decided to do a fully independent release on our own website. And yeah, it's important. You know, this isn't something that was influenced by any streaming platform. It wasn't, you know, that wasn't even the goal, to be honest, of making it. It's something that we, you know, decided to do fully independently. So, you know, anybody who wants to watch it to support independent film, you know, and this effort, which again has been like 10 years in the making, I mean, it would be incredible to have, yeah, to have it go far and wide, and for people to, you know, to support it, because there aren't that many outlets for independent film. You know, I know a lot of comedians these days are, you know, doing their own specials and self-funding their own specials and putting them online. And I know that there's a big market for that, but, you know, independent documentaries, that has yet to be, that's a business model that has yet to be proven. So, yeah. So hoping we can get the support from, you know, all your listeners and everybody, like, you know, to come and see it and to support the effort, that would be amazing.
And I'm so happy, just one last thing, I'm so happy for you with the theatrical piece, because especially in today's world with, like, and you know this, being, you know, a social media influencer as well, with TikTok and Instagram, and even with podcasts, like when people listen to podcasts, they can be multitasking. Like, you got to have this experience of people, because people pretty much, I feel like being in a theater, like seeing a show is like the one time people aren't on their phones, like they're actually just engaged. So it's really exciting to know that so many people will actually have that moment of, you know, just being there with your film and experiencing it. And then, so for listeners, because when this, I think we're airing this to align, I believe, with the release. So where can listeners go to watch it?
Yeah. So littleemptyboxes.com is our website. It's the name of the film. Yeah. People can watch it there. That's the ask. Just watch the film and, you know, really feel it, dedicate an evening to it. Watch it with family. It's been at the theaters, it's been really powerful. A lot of people have been showing up, you know, mothers and daughters, fathers and sons, mothers and sons. It's just been like incredible. And siblings have been, you know, showing up. It's a really powerful film to watch with family, because it is a film about the ones we love. It's a film about family and yeah, just make a night out of it.
I'm going to have to watch it again with my family. Okay, so friends, go to littleemptyboxes.com now. I promise you, you will not regret it. It is such an incredible journey to watch it. So definitely go there now. We'll put links in the show notes as well. The last question I ask every single guest on the show, you might remember it from last time, but it's just because I do really, really appreciate the importance and value of mindset. So what is something that you're grateful for?
Oh, well, I'm grateful, I guess, for my family. I'm grateful for my mom, of course. She was an amazing mom and the only mom I'll ever know. I'm grateful for my dad, who's still alive. And I'm grateful for my brothers. My mom raised me and my brothers to be very close with one another, knowing that family is everything. You know, I know a lot of people who don't have the kind of relationship with their brothers that I have with mine, and I'm super grateful for that. We were all incredibly supportive for one another during this time, which was the most traumatic time I've ever experienced. I'm grateful for my cat, Delilah, who is the best cat on earth. She's amazing. Yeah, that's it. Family.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Max. Like I said, I'm so grateful for everything that you're doing, and I have been for years, and you're changing so many lives, and to see you do it in this, you know, new medium is just astounding. So thank you so much. I look forward to everything in the future.
Thank you, Melanie, so much for having me. It was an honor.
Thanks, Max. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information, you can check out my book, What When Wine, Lose Weight and Feel Great with Paleo Style Meals, Intermittent Fasting, and Wine, as well as my blog, melanieavalon.com. Feel free to contact me at podcast@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.